From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's July 4th. Incredible, actually, that we made it here. And all over America, people are celebrating Independence Day with cookouts and, judging from the sounds in my neighborhood this week, more than a few fireworks. Here at Good Food, we're taking the day to reflect on this word, independence. In a 1979 commencement speech at Barnard University, Toni Morrison spoke to the graduating class of women about freedom and power. She said, "You are moving in the direction of freedom. The function of freedom is to free someone else." Fannie Lou Hamer and Audre Lorde famously made this same point. "I am not free until you are free." I always say that food is a lens. So today we look through that lens and pose the question, who is free? To write their own story, to record their own recipes, to dine where they want to dine, to own land. In 2015, I spoke to culinary journalist Toni Tipton Martin about her book, The Jemima Code, Two Centuries of African-American Cookbooks. It's a groundbreaking bibliographic work that shares the names and stories of men and women pushed aside by history. And before we dive in, I want to share a quick update to our conversation. Earlier this month, Quaker Oats announced that the Aunt Jemima line of foods will rebrand with a new name and image. But as you can hear in our conversation from 2015, this is a debate that has been going on for years. Okay, now let's dig into her book. One of the things that I find really fascinating is the comparison to how these days we hear about young chefs, quote, staging at the hand of an experienced and often famous pro. And we talk about how tough these old-fashioned apprenticeships are that can last a few years. And yet, the people, particularly in the beginning of your bibliography, who wrote these books, went through much more challenging apprenticeships to end up feeding white families with tremendous skill and creativity. Could you speak a bit about that?
Yeah, so when we think about culinary apprenticeships, we generally don't apply those practices to African Americans who have worked in the kitchen under the tutelage of other professional and talented and wise cooks or chefs. That's part of the rationale for the title, The Jemima Code. We live with codes every day, and they're a way of communicating a message from one entity to another using symbols. This Aunt Jemima symbol has been encoded with so many multiple characteristics and behaviors and thoughts about a group of people that has provoked other groups of people to have a response to them, if that makes any sense. And so if that original line of thinking was that these were people who were performing all of the hard labor and doing so without much intelligence or conveying any levels of professionalism, no technique, not really practicing any management skills, then they go down in history as unimportant, as unintelligent, or they go down in history as immensely talented cooks, but that somehow they learned it through, or they were gifted with it through some kind of voodoo magic or a mystique, natural instinct, if you will. And so what I wanted to do was be sure that we are clear that these people trained on the job beginning at very, very early ages as enslaved children. They would have been out in the woods with their moms hunting berries and collecting wild nuts. They would have observed and participated in things like plucking feathers from chickens. And those are skills today that we revere and pay lots of money for and give lots of credit to modern chefs for having that knowledge.
You quote a woman, Tara Hunter, saying that everything she does is out of her head. It's all brain work. And you characterize it as really a miracle of memory and oral transmission. So this all happens in a place and a moment where it's illegal to teach slaves to read and write.
That's right. And Tara Hunter, by the way, is the scholar who actually did quite a bit of work about women, research about women and their work. And that quote is from a formerly enslaved woman who was interviewed in the 30s during the Works Progress Administration's interviews with former slaves. And so these are people who would have been children in slavery, but were now senior citizens reflecting on what life had been like for them. And here, without knowing it, is this elderly woman who's talking about something that the chef Michael Ruhlman called mental mise en place. And that is the idea that everything has to be in its place and organized before one gets started in the kitchen, so that you aren't running next door to borrow that proverbial cup of sugar, if you will. And so here are these cooks who have been working that way their entire lives. They had no ability to read or write, and yet they memorized hundreds of recipes working either for employers in domestic servitude or as caterers, as hoteliers, and then, of course, as enslaved peoples.
So I'd love to drill down into some of the examples of the books in your collection. And let's start with the first one, The House Servants Directory by Robert Roberts. When you read that book and you see how much houseworkers were expected to know, it's to say that they weren't skilled managers is just insane.
Yeah, Robert Roberts was the butler in the governor's mansion in Massachusetts. And what I love about him is exactly as you describe it. From him, we learn a few recipes, of course. But what we really learn about him is his work ethic and what he valued for workers in the household, how to run a fine home in New England. And what shouldn't be lost on any of us is the degree of minutiae that involved, things like understanding how many inches the tablecloth could hang on either side of the ends of the table, or which direction the flower bowl should face. And there are dozens and dozens of other examples, because, of course, he is training someone to follow in his footsteps. And so this person does have to know all of that. But he also communicates to them the nuances of interpersonal skills. He's very interested in cleanliness and being prompt at work. And he isn't the only one. That kind of messaging really shows up throughout the period of 150 years that we chose to profile in the book.
Many of the earlier collections were either self-published or they were privately funded by free women of color and former slaves. Was it more common to have a former slave who after slavery managed to become quite successful as a caterer, for example, or a small manufacturer, be discovered by their white clients and have those white clients bring out a book?
Well, the practice of white clients publishing the recipes of their black servants, whether they were employees or caterers, is quite popular. What changes over time is how visible the white transcriber, right? That's what these people were, was the transcriber for someone who was unable to read or write. The degree of their involvement, their physical presence in the storyline is what changes. So over time, white people were involved very much in the publishing of these books, from the initial wanting to just create more employees to ultimately a time period where they wanted to claim responsibility for the intelligence and the creative outcomes, the recipes that these people were making. And so they degraded them. In the 30s, they began to really demoralize these women in particular through images and words that made the black cooks seem like buffoons.
So what volume is generally cited as the first American cookbook to be published under the name of an African-American writer?
Well, the Robert Roberts book is significant beyond just its being the first in this collection and the first of what we know to be a book that has any recipes in it. But it's also the first book that we know of any kind that was published by an African-American in the trade. But for a long time, it's been disregarded in food circles because it's not strictly a recipe book. So in that way, the very first book to be self-published by an African-American comes in 1866, and it was published by a free woman of color named Melinda Russell. And Melinda Russell explains quite a bit about herself. She tells us her motives for publishing. She's trying to raise money to return home to Tennessee. She has a handicapped child. So I really like talking about her as a working woman. She's an amazing inspiration to today's young women who find themselves on the fringes of society, frustrated young mothers, not sure which way to turn. And here's a woman who, just a year after slaves were free, is publishing a book and talking about her abilities as a caterer and the gratitude she has for the white women in her community who help her get published so she can go home.
So let's talk about Aunt Jemima. Are there campaigns to get rid of her? And are black cooks today still being marginalized?
I have seen a campaign by some young people on the internet who at one point were lobbying Quaker to remove her image from the package, but I'm not entirely sure that that's the response we should be having to that trademark. I like to challenge researchers to find out how much money she's made as a corporate trademark and to recognize her quality, you know, the value that she's conveyed for that product. In terms of how we're still treated in this industry, I don't think that a lot has changed. I took this book project to the internet in a blog form because I couldn't get it published. And so I took the message to the internet, and lo and behold, UT Press came along and did respect the material and accepted the challenge. And that was really a positive statement for us all that there is hope that we can come together as one around the table if we leave all of those artificially contrived differences at the door.
Toni Tipton Martin is a culinary historian, food writer, and cookbook author. In 2015, I spoke to her about her award-winning book, The Jemima Code, Two Centuries of African-American Cookbooks. And last year, she published the award-winning cookbook, Jubilee. Coming up, The Food of Zora Neale Hurston. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. The Negro Motorist Green Book was considered the Bible of Black travel, a guide that clued African Americans into safe roadside stops during Jim Crow. The Green Book listed more than 220 sites in Los Angeles alone, from restaurants and hotels to taverns and chicken shacks. Cultural documentarian Candace Taylor is on a mission to document them all from coast to coast. In 2016, she took my supervising producer at that time, Abby Fentress Swanson, to one of the sites still standing in South LA. And then she stopped by the Good Food Studio to discuss the importance of preserving these sites.
How's everybody?
How are you doing?
Okay. Oh, man, I'm doing all right. Yeah.
The Dunbar was built in 1928 by a man named John Alexander Somerville. And he was a black dentist who was just tired of being thrown out of places because he was black. So he built this. It was called the Somerville Hotel at the time. For this to be around since 1928, it was such a fabulous Spanish colonial building. beautiful architecture. Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington stayed here, Sarah Vaughan. There was an adjoining beauty shop and a liquor store that was also listed in the Green Book. That space next to us is going to be a restaurant that's opening up in 2017. But it was also one of the first hotels in America built expressly for Black people. Right down the street, Club Alabama was also a Green Book listing, and that's where Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington would go for after hours. That place was open from like midnight to 6 a.m. Jack's Chicken Basket, the Chicken Shack was down the street. And they've kept it active, and it's such a great use for it, you know, for low-income housing, for seniors. Just really nice. And we're in South Central, so just remember that, don't believe what you read in the papers.
Hi, Candace, how are you?
Hi, I'm well.
Another Green Book site here in L.A. is the infamous Clifton's Cafeteria downtown. For people who may not know it, describe Clifton's and tell us why it was so important for the Black community back in the day.
Well, Clifton's was a special place, and it still is. You know, it's a five-story cafeteria, first of all, so that's unique in and of itself. It was owned by a man named Clifford Clinton, who was an incredible humanitarian, and he was a Christian in the real sense of the word. You know, he had seen abject poverty. He had traveled to China as missionary with his parents. He just could not accept that a country this wealthy as America would have people hungry. So when he opened up his restaurant, he swore he would feed everybody, regardless of whether they were able to pay. And that's what made Clifton's very different. Right on the menu, it said, pay what you wish, dine unless delighted. He sold so many 5-cent meals and gave away free meals. It was a Depression-era restaurant, and it was listed in the Green Book. So he opened it up and integrated the space.
And at the time, was it one of the few integrated restaurants in Los Angeles?
Well, Los Angeles was a unique place. When you look at America at that time and you see that, you know, the South had its Jim Crow laws and people assumed that the rest of the country was liberal, or especially the West. You know, in California, we think, oh, we're so liberal out here. But the truth was, segregation was in full force throughout the country. And it was even more confusing and even more dangerous to leave the South if you were Black and just travel West, because you didn't know where you were welcome or not, because there were no signs. And that's why the Green Book was still really critical, even in places like downtown Los Angeles.
Now, I understand that you're trying to document every Green Book site on Route 66. Why?
Well, I'm actually looking to document Green Book sites throughout the country. I started on Route 66 because I developed a partnership with the National Park Service, and I was writing a book on Route 66. It was a travel guide. And I was just struck at how little had been written about the route in terms of its earlier days. It started in 1926. A lot of the things we read and learn about Route 66 is that heyday, 1950s, quote unquote, good old days of the white suburban families who jump in their Airstream trailers. And being a Black woman myself, I thought there's got to be more to this story. And I was just tired of 99% of all the people who've written books about Route 66 are white males. I felt like there's got to be a different angle here. And I wondered, where were the Black people who drove Route 66? And then I learned about the Green Book. I reached out to the National Park Service because they have a Route 66 corridor preservation program. And the director there, Kaisa Berthuli, was just really loved my work. I loved what they were doing. And she said, we'd love for you to document some of these sites.
Does L.A. have more preserved sites from the Green Book than a lot of other cities?
Not particularly more than other cities. New York has a densest concentration of Green Book sites because Victor H. Green, who created the Green Book, was a postal worker. He was from New York. And the first Green Book was published in 1936. And he felt like, even in New York, I need to figure out where we can go that's comfortable. And so he started it. It was inspired by Jewish travel guides in the 30s that were being developed for the Borscht Belt.
What's the most unusual site that you found?
Oh, it's hard to say, but there is one that stands out in my mind. In Victorville, California, there's a site called Murray's Dude Ranch, and it was quite special. It was billed as the only Negro dude ranch in America. You know, Pearl Bailey bought it in the 50s, and she ran it for a while. Joe Louis used to come there, and he had his entourage, the boxer.
You know, it was on the cover of Ebony magazine. It was well known. And when you look at these photographs of these black men in cowboy hats and, you know, a lot of kids, it was one of the first places where there was integration between black and white children playing in recreational spaces. This was unheard of. You know, this was something that throughout the country, blacks were expressly kept out of recreational sites or pools or any type of place where kids would play together. Even in Pasadena, there was a pool that was segregated. They had International Day, quote unquote, and it was the last day before they would clean the pool. So it was when the pool was the most dirtiest was when blacks could use it. And then they made sure to tell white people, don't worry, after the blacks get out, we are going to clean it. This was the reality, you know, that we were dealing with in California. Another thing about Route 66 that's interesting to note in terms of like how I came into this project is because there were sundown towns throughout the United States.
Describe what that means.
Sundown towns were all white communities, and they were all white on purpose. James Loewen is a sociologist out of Harvard who wrote a book called Sundown Towns. And he's estimated that there were over 10,000 of these sundown towns throughout the country. So again, most people assume that segregation and the Jim Crow laws were corralled in the South, but that really wasn't the case. Once you left the South, there were sundown towns, which was largely a Northern phenomenon. And these towns were all white. You could not be in the town if you were black after 6 p.m. Again, you didn't quite know if you were passing through a sundown town. Some of them had signs that literally just said, nigger, don't let the sun go down on you here. But there were other towns you didn't quite know. Sometimes they would ring a bell at 6 o'clock, and you would know what that meant. Anybody black who was working in the town would know what that meant, and they knew they had to leave. But if you were driving through, you wouldn't know. And it's estimated that there were 44 out of the 89 counties along Route 66 were sundown towns. So
you had to keep moving along.
You had to have a plan. You had to make sure that when you were driving through, you weren't going to be passing through one of these sundown towns after 6 p.m. You needed the green book to figure out where you could stay. Once you even got to a multicultural or, say, more, you know, ethnic place like Albuquerque, where there was a large Latino population and American Indian population, even once you got to Albuquerque on Route 66, out of the 100 motels that lined Central Avenue along Route 66, only about 6 of them accepted black people. Again, if you didn't have that guide, once you were there, you'd be knocking on doors and being turned away. So there was a very real threat to personal safety, and there was also just simple convenience of getting from A to B, specifically on Route 66. And with sundown towns, even once you got out to California, Glendale was a sundown town, Culver City, Burbank were sundown towns. Well into the 60s, Glendale was.
Wow. I want to talk a little bit about conservation. The Dunbar's on the National Register of Historic Places, and Clifton's just got this famous $10 million facelift, so it's not going anywhere soon either. Are there efforts to conserve other Green Book sites that aren't currently being protected?
Well, I'm leading the charge on that because I feel like it's really important. You know, I got a couple of grants in the last year. I got a grant from the Graham Foundation, which was an architecture grant, to specifically look at these buildings, to catalog what condition they were in, to photograph them and document them. And we estimated that less than a quarter are really still standing. And of that quarter, there are so few that are still operating, especially under the same name. So when you find one, you want to make sure people know about it, people know what it is. I've reached out to the city planner here in L.A., Ken Bernstein, and he's been very receptive to acknowledging Green Book sites and putting them on their website, listing them as culturally significant and historically significant places. I got a grant from the California Humanities to capture the stories surrounding these Green Book sites and the people who ran them. So this is a way to really capture that history as well, and to look at even other people who were not black who owned Green Book sites, like Clifford Clinton, the Biltmore, the Bel Air Hotel in L.A. You know, it's like, what's the story behind that? Why did the Bel Air advertise in the Green Book? So capturing those stories, I think, are really important. So I think in terms of preservation and conservation, it'll be different per state or per city.
It seems like it couldn't be more perfectly timed as another way to re-examine our relationship with race and migration, segregation, and integration.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is really an important, I think in terms of civil rights, it's pretty obvious that we're still struggling with this issue, right? And to me, it's always been really important to bring the Green Book out of the past and really have an opportunity to reevaluate our relationship with racial segregation. Because, you know, even though the Green Book was this very practical and innovative solution to a horrific situation, you know, physical mobility getting from A to B was dangerous, could be deadly. So the Green Book was a wonderful, resourceful, innovative solution to that. But today, you know, I would argue that social mobility is just as debilitating and just as deadly. And so it's different, but not so different, right? I mean, I remember being 7 years old as a kid in Texas, being in a car with my mother, and we were driving through Sugar Land, which was an old, right now it's a very exclusive suburb, but at the time, it was sugarcane fields. And there were all these black men in the fields chained up. And I remember at 7 years old saying, "Mom, I thought slavery was over. I thought we learned that in school, that slavery was over." And she said, "It is, honey." And I said, "Well, why are all these black men chained up in a field?" And she said, "Well, they're prisoners." And I said, "Well, why are they all black?" And she just couldn't answer. She couldn't explain, I guess, institutional racism to a 7-year-old. But at that age, it was very clear to me that we had a problem, that something was wrong. And now, you know, that was in the 70s when we only had about 300,000 men, you know, incarcerated. Now we have 2.3 million. In terms of what we've done socially in regards to race, in terms of, like I said, social mobility, the neighborhoods that most of these Green Book sites are located in, because they tend to be clustered in what were traditional African-American neighborhoods, like South Central, like Harlem, you know, in Chicago, the Bronzeville district, south side of Chicago. I think we can learn something about where these properties were located, the conditions and the, you know, the fact that these neighborhoods, many of which have been neglected, been abandoned by society and by policy that's created horrific situations and war zones in some cases, I think can tell us about where we've been and where we're going. And what makes it so exciting that some of these buildings actually still exist, it's physical evidence that it happened. And it's also an opportunity for us to go to a site of sanctuary and reflect on where we've been and where we are and what we can do about it.
That was author, photographer, and cultural documentarian Candace Taylor. I interviewed her in 2016 about her work documenting Green Book sites on Route 66. Earlier this year, she published a new book that encompasses her research. It's called Overground Railroad: The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. In contrast to the sundown towns of the North and West, Eatonville, Florida was built by and for the Black community. It was the first all-Black city to be incorporated into the state of Florida in the year 1887, and it's the town where famed writer, folklorist, and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston was raised in the late 19th and early 20th century. I first read Zora Neale Hurston as a teenager, randomly discovering her book, Their Eyes Were Watching God. As a young woman, the book opened a door to a culture and life about which I knew basically nothing. Hurston's books are riveting, filled with horror and grace. The people she writes about are often the struggling poor, and food figures predominantly in her stories. In 2015, I spoke to historian Frederick Douglass Opie about how she used food in her work. Hi there, Fred.
Hi, Evan.
What made you want to explore Florida food through Zora Neale Hurston's eyes?
Well, as you mentioned in the intro, I also read Their Eyes Are Watching God, and I've used it in one of my courses on history, and just was amazed at how much food was in it. So it made me begin to think, okay, so if it's in this book, this woman's been prolific as far as publications in a number of genres, what else does she have to say about food and the rest of her work?
And she's an interesting person because she was born in Alabama, to sharecropper parents, but she moved, her family moved to Eatonville, Florida, which was quite a particular town during the time. Could you describe it?
Yes, it's one of the oldest all-black townships. It was founded at the turn of the century, and it was very unique for its time. Again, we're talking about the height of Jim Crow. Just briefly so everybody understands, after 1877, federal troops were removed from the South following the Civil War, and anybody who wanted to turn back the political dial of the South could wreak havoc on African Americans. So if you had a black township, it means you had political independence and sovereignty from white racist. So it was a very unusual experience for anybody in the South during that time.
So let's talk about this town, Eatonville, where Zora Neale Hurston really grew up, and sort of the circle of community food. Were there sharecroppers, or did people own their own plots of land that also had their house?
You had a black upper class, very small percentage of people who had money, like Joe Clark from Joe Clark's only store in the town. But there is no sharecroppers. You had blacks who were day workers who would work for other people who would go to other communities, like Tea Cake. Tea Cake in the story is a guy who's kind of a roustabout, not from Eatonville, but would make his way through different towns. Most people were farmers, self-sufficient farmers, subsistence farmers. Her father was a preacher. She's a PK kid, and her father, like many ministers at that time, was the pastor of several churches, but he also raised just about everything that the family consumed.
In her case, the general store assumed a really big importance.
The general store is everything. It's where you purchase those things that you can't grow, things like salt or other spices, sugar. It's the place where you get your mail. It's the post office. There, in other instances, it's the barber shop. It is the place where you go to meet friends and to share and swap, stories.
Let's start talking about some of her stories and some of the food that figured importantly, like pig's feet.
Now, related to the general store, I mean, what's really interesting is the definition of courting food. If you were courting somebody and you wanted to impress them, now you'd give them chocolate. Back then, you'd get them a pig's foot. I mean, that was like, wow, I really like you type of food. So if you looked at what would be on the counter of a store like Joe Clark's, it would be a large bottle of pickled pig's feet. Other things that you see as she goes out into the field, she interviews and spend time, and she's embedded, as it were, in several different type of work camps. One of them is a sawmill camp, turpentine camp, and then plantation, agricultural plantations, where people will be picking anything from beans to grapefruits to oranges. So around those spaces, things like pickles, pig's feet would show up at a Saturday night party. Most of these people worked 6 days a week, and they would get paid maybe on Friday or Saturday night, and that's when they'd let their hair down and party. And so you see pig's feet, you see fried chicken, you see things like fried gator. You see all types of moonshine. It's amazing to me what people can make alcohol out of. The other important part of that leisure culture in the Florida areas that she studies in the backwoods are juke joints. And juke joints have great music, jazz, blues music, food, a lot of times barbecue, and then chicken and pork we talked about. And then the other thing is this unbelievable moonshine. Those are the three things that you see in juke joints where a lot of the workers that she studied and took down their folklore from were in these spaces. And they were dangerous places. You know, she was a bit of she was like, I don't know if you call her a loose cannon or a voyager, but there are scenes that she describes where fights break out and people are pulling razors out and shooting, and she's hiding underneath the chair. Or she quickly finds out who is the biggest, baddest, and toughest woman in that joint and becomes their best friend.
Smart lady. We've been talking a lot about barbecue on the show. where does Florida barbecue have its roots, and how is it different from barbecue that we might see in Texas or the Carolinas?
Florida barbecue is essentially whole hog barbecue done on over an open pit. I mean, deep open pits. It's wood barbecue, always wood, pecan, apple, a number of those type of woods, hickory, but it's pork almost all the time. Sometimes you'll see chicken barbecued. Sometimes, you know, you might see things with some stews, but the center of barbecue in Florida is definitely pork.
And what does the diddy-wah-diddy have to do with this?
The diddy-wah-diddy is this mystical city. It's almost like a fairy tale land. And this, at the center of this fairy tale land, this is one of the folklores that she collects on her travels, is that this is a place where, first of all, there is no Jim Crow. No work is not even described. It's a place where you can go and hang out and have fun. It's a juke joint without getting shot, and the food comes up to you. So you're sitting and waiting or talking with a friend at a bench in diddy-wah-diddy, and who pulls up to the curb? It's not the popo or the cops. It's a piece of baked chicken with a fork in it waiting for you to eat, or a piece of sweet potato pie with a fork in it waiting for you to eat. It's a really interesting scenario that she talks about, and numerous people talk about that as a folklore, diddy-wah-diddy.
So interesting. Thank you so much, Fred. This has been great.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Frederick Douglass Opie. We've been talking about his book, Zora Neale Hurston on Florida Food, Recipes, Remedies, and Simple Pleasures. Coming up, The Color of Food, Stories of Race, Resilience, and Farming. That's in 1 minute on Good Food. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. 95% of America's farmers are white. There are 3.2 million of them, according to the last agricultural census in 2017. The same census documented only 45,000 Black farmers in the U.S. This number is actually up 2% from the former 2012 census, but, and there is always a but, ownership is declining even faster for Black farmers. In 2015, I spoke to writer, farmer, and community activist Natasha Bowens about her book, The Color of Food, where she challenges the status quo of America's agrarian identity. Hi, Natasha.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So there are some kind of obvious obstacles that all farmers face, climate change, big ag. But what are some additional challenges that farmers of color are up against?
Well, you know, as we know, in agriculture, we're losing a lot of agricultural land. But as you stated, farmers of color are losing that land at much higher rates. There are also a lot of barriers and discriminatory policies in play that are keeping farmers of color from accessing, having fair access to resources such as USDA loans or other lending agents. And this is ending up in foreclosure and land loss. There's also, you know, discrimination just kind of woven into a lot of our systems that are affecting farmers at market and being able to access market. So they're facing a lot heavier barriers than our average farmer today.
I understand that there was actually a large suit filed against the USDA.
Well, there's several. The largest one that I think gained some media attention was Pigford versus USDA, Pigford versus Glickman, and that was the Black farmer discrimination lawsuit that was settled in 2012, the same year that I got on the road for this book. And it was actually the second part of a much larger lawsuit, Pigford 1 and then Pigford 2, because after Pigford 1, they realized that there were thousands more Black farmers that had claims of discrimination from their local USDA agents that weren't able to join the settlement, so they expanded it.
So, in fact, the USDA has ended up paying out huge amounts of money in settlements because of the institutional racism that their policies have put forth all these years.
Yes, huge amounts of money that were divided up among thousands of farmers. So each farming family ended up with roughly $50,000. And unfortunately, with the age of farmers today being around 57 and for Black farmers around 63, a lot of these farmers died waiting for their settlement money. And when it came, it didn't really compensate for what was lost in that time.
So you went on the road to talk to quite a few farmers. What is it in your personal history that compelled you to have these stories told?
Well, I never grew up farming. My family thought I was a little crazy when I called them up and told them I was leaving my job in D.C., working as a healthcare policy advocate to pick up the pitchfork and start farming. But working on environmental issues, healthcare issues, and social justice issues, I really felt compelled to focus on what I thought was at the center of all of these issues, and that's our food and how it's grown, how it's distributed. So I started farming, but I was instantly kind of struck with a lot of contradicting feelings about this trade. Not only looking around and seeing that there weren't a lot of people that looked like me as a young woman of color out on the farm and in this kind of hipster movement that swept the nation, and also the racial inequities that I was seeing in the food system as far as food access. But personally, thinking about my ancestors and, you know, the history of agriculture in this country and how that, you know, plays out for African Americans, knowing that my great-grandmother grew up on a sharecropping farm and, you know, worked in the kitchens for wealthy white families in South Carolina, I felt really conflicted digging my hands into the soil and wondering if this was a place for me. Would my ancestors be proud of me going back to a trade that they worked hard to free me of? Or, on the other hand, was this kind of an empowering way to get back to a connection with the land and with our food that I feel like my generation has lost?
Did you find that to be a common thread as you talk to young people of color that come from both African American and immigrant communities?
Most definitely. In fact, when I announced to some of my friends that I was going to farm, they said, well, what are you doing going back to picking cotton or going back to the field? And that's when I really started exploring these questions of race and the history of agriculture for people of color on my blog, Brown Girl Farming, and hearing from folks from around the country that really felt the same way and were really grappling with this feeling of kind of the pain and trauma that is in our communities with agriculture, not just African Americans, but as you mentioned, a lot of young immigrant folks who are, you know, born first generation here and their parents might have come from an agrarian country to end up here with limited choices, working as farm workers and migrant laborers, and being appalled that their young, you know, son or daughter now wanted to join the agricultural movement. But as I wrote more and heard back from more folks and got out on the road, it started to change. While that's there, really I started seeing this as, you know, the farm is a place where we can really claim our cultural heritage, our cultural foodways, have ownership over our land, have sovereignty over our food, and really kind of take it back and change that.
So share with us some of your favorite stories that you gathered when you were on the road.
I have so many.
Maybe I know that you visited several Native American reservations.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because one of my favorites that I tell often is on one of the Native American reservations in the Cherokee Nation. So in Cherokee, North Carolina, it's home to the eastern band of the Cherokee Nation. And there I met Mr. Kevin Welch, who is a Cherokee farmer and runs the Center for Cherokee Plants. And the Center for Cherokee Plants is a seed bank, essentially. But Kevin would tell you it's not a typical seed bank. He doesn't sit on the seeds. He's propagating and bringing back to life a lot of heirloom Cherokee plants and then giving them out in garden kits to all the residents on the Cherokee Reservation, which, as we know, in many Native American communities, is home to rampant diabetes and heart disease and a lot of health issues, loss of land, lack of healthy food access. So not only is he bringing back plants that, you know, are on the brink of extinction and important to the Cherokee people, but he's also giving them tools to grow their own food and take back their health.
So how can the millennial generation act as change makers to bridge some of the old farming models and create real change?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned bridging some of the old farming models. The book ends with the section of stories from folks from my generation. And they're coming up with great innovative ideas, but they're also honoring and recognizing that a lot of these ideas stem from practices that our ancestors, that our elders have practiced in the past. Things like cooperatives and working together, having cooperatively owned stores, having cooperatively owned food businesses, you know, bringing back the mom and pop shops. One young food activist in New Orleans in the Lower Ninth Ward that I interviewed, Jenga Mwendo, spoke about creating a food policy council in her community and gathering the community together to envision what they want for their food system and really hearing that they wanted things to kind of go back to the way they were when in the Lower Ninth Ward, where there was a over 70% home ownership rate before Hurricane Katrina, and they were Black-owned businesses and a butcher and a baker and just more of a community-owned food system. And those are some of the really great old ways that we used to do things with this, you know, new innovative twist on them that we really have potential for in this country.
Natasha Bowen's 2015 book is The Color of Food: Stories of Race, Resilience, and Farming. After the break, Tunde Wei tells us if we want to confront white supremacy in America, just look to the restaurant industry. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. There are few people in the food world who have made a bigger impact on me than Tunde Wei. In 2016, I attended his Blackness in America event at Good Girl Dinette in Highland Park. It was part of a roving dinner series where Wei served the Nigerian fare he left behind after moving to the U.S. at age 16. But the jollof rice, quail, and braised trotter stew he served were secondary to the conversation at the table, where discomfort was the main course.
You know, I try to create spaces where food and commentary intersect. Before I started this dinner series, I was cooking Nigerian food and sharing that, traveling on the road. And that was a protest against contemporary food culture. You mentioned my first course being ugly. That was part of the plan. You know, when I first started, I felt like there was too much focus on superficial things. You know, there was too much focus on where the provenance of the food, for example, you know, who made the food, how well the food was arranged on the plate. It was funny and almost ironic because what was bombastic about the food was not the flavor. It was just like everything else that people had attached to the food. And that was, for me, upside down. So I decided to start cooking Nigerian food and sharing that as a way to protest that. And very quickly, I realized that that protest was frivolous and also trivial, because food culture is part of a larger system of power and oppression. And that's why I decided to shift away from this light statement to hopefully a more impactful one, talking about race. And I think that, well, for most people who are eating my food, they haven't had Nigerian food before, or if they have had it, they're not familiar with it. And so to bring food to this space where we're having uncomfortable conversations is for me to dislocate people from any frame of reference. And then hopefully in doing so, make them more susceptible to different opportunities of thought. So that's where the two, I guess, for me, come together.
How have the dinners been received by people who have been in that space that you create that can be pretty uncomfortable?
Evan, come on now. You were there.
Yeah, but it's not up to me to say.
No, actually, it is up to you to say. I want to hear your experience of your dinner.
Incredibly uncomfortable. But I knew it would be. And I felt that I had a responsibility to be the recipient of the discomfort. But I can't stop thinking about it.
That's good.
Yeah. I want to talk to you a bit about being African rather than African-American. And this conversation that has started to happen pretty recently, seriously, about culinary appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big set of conversations that went on in response to an Eater article about how chefs in Charleston are positioned and who creates what and who gets credit for what, a certain kind of Southern cuisine or West African cuisine.
I'm not very familiar with, you know, these sort of like regional differences. I know that Gala, Geechee food is food from Africans, you know, Africans who were brought here to be slaves and work on the rice fields. And they have kept their tradition, their language, their culture. And a huge part of their culture is their food. In that piece, I just sort of like laid out from my perspective, not speaking necessarily to food. I don't think either of us were in the piece, but speaking to the propensity of white folks and folks with privilege to co-opt very easily and comfortably other people's culture, other people's work, to tweak it maybe, and to relabel it as theirs. And there is this sort of positive reinforcement they get from the hard work that it takes to co-opt something. You know, it takes work to be a thief sometimes. And so because there's work behind this, that hard work is conflated with a right or a privilege to own this thing that isn't theirs. So I guess that's sort of like my position, is give credit where it's due, but you can't give credit by mentioning names. There is a material benefit that accrues to folks who are benefiting from Black food culture. People are getting rich off of this. So when you give credit, the credit has to extend in that direction as well. And to be honest, just don't do it. I guess that's what I would say. Like, don't do it to start off with, is what I would say.
One of the things that I found interesting about the dinner and the conversation was, I think you talked about how white diners at the dinners are often after like an immediate a solution.
Mm-hmm.
You feel guilt for your white privilege and you're looking for something that can immediately flip a switch.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is kind of missing the point?
I don't think there is a solution. And even if there was a solution, we're not going to find it at a dinner table. So there isn't a solution in my mind. If there is a solution, and I hope there is, it's not in any of our lifetimes. The effect of the solution, the grand effect, isn't in our lifetimes, because the sort of like interwoven and convoluted history that got us here is long and deep. And to expect that we can fix that in such a short time is a hubris that only a certain kind of person has. So I think there isn't a solution, but there are many, many opportunities for action. Parallel actions, actions that acknowledge a long, long-term solution, but that do work to address certain material and spiritual deficits. Part of the actions that I think are necessary is discomfort. Like, that is an action, to be uncomfortable.
A few months after that conversation, I spoke to Tunde again after he wrote an op-ed for the San Francisco Chronicle, where he said, if you want to look at America's white supremacy problem, just look to the food world. It was 2017, and Bon Appetit had just crowned Turkey and the Wolf, a white-owned hipster sandwich shop in New Orleans, as the best restaurant in America. And Tunde was calling them out. Hearing this segment now, 4 months into a global pandemic and just weeks after a massive upheaval at Bon Appetit, much has changed. But the conversation is just as relevant.
We live in a society where race plays a significant role. The Bon Appetit pick is proof of that, that a restaurant in the style and in the sort of like aesthetic sentiment of Turkey and the Wolf, which is the restaurant that was picked as the best new restaurant, is lauded. But there's so many other restaurants owned by non-white people in that same style that never get the acknowledgement or the look. You know, we are sort of fed the idea that there's a certain like aesthetic or a certain expectation that gets unrewarded. But the truth is, it's neither the expectation, nor the style, nor the aesthetic, nor the approach. It's the ideology which validates and highlights whiteness. That is what is rewarded over and over again. And when other non-white ideas, non-white perspectives and people are recognized, is usually in a tokenized fashion. And I think this is something that we have to be honest and address if we want things to change as we say we do.
You know, it's so interesting for me to think about this, because I think about restaurants that we go to and we love because they have a, quote, authenticity to them, or they're connected. They're connected in some way to a culture, a deep culture. And so we respond to them because we're being fed something that is real. And then there's the kind of restaurant that is very popular now, which is very meta. It borrows from a real culture, but sits above it. And those are the restaurants that are getting the attention. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
I think you have more experience in this field than I do, so I would defer to you. But I would say that I recognize what you're saying, you know, and I think there's a space for those kinds of restaurants, you know, restaurants that are that permit a certain kind of abstraction, right? That lets you be present as you eat the meal, but also lets you sort of like recognize something different, like sort of like look outside of yourself in that space. And I think that's wonderful. I think what is missing from those restaurants and from a lot of restaurants is that whether we are serving abstractions or we're serving critiques or we're just serving entertainment, there is no morality. There is nothing there besides this vacuous comment. We are in a place where we can't afford to be neutral or to not have a position. It is important to me and the work that I do and the, sort of like the dining spaces that I try to create to inject a morality, to inject a point of view, because we are all politicized, whether we choose to accept it or not. And the people who generally don't want to recognize their politics are the people who have the privilege not to. And so whatever sort of personal privilege or influence that I have, my goal is to direct all of that to politicizing spaces that haven't been and that choose not to be, so that we can all sort of like lay it out on the table and say, this is who we are and this is what we must change if we want to change.
Tunde Wei is an activist and chef who investigates food and food media in America. Those conversations were recorded in 2016 and 2017. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. Thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laro Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Kat Yore, Paul Smith, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. Happy 4th of July to everyone. Stay safe, wear your mask, and I will be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.